Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. S-Town meets I'll Be Gone in the Dark in this stranger-than-fiction cold case from rural Oklahoma that has stumped authorities for two decades concerning the disappearance of two teenage girls and the much larger mystery of murder, possible police cover-up, and an unimaginable truth. On December 30th, 1999, in rural Oklahoma, 16-year-old Ashley Freeman and her best friend, Loria Bible, were having a sleepover. The next morning, the Freeman family trailer was in flames and both girls were missing. While rumors of drug debts, revenge, and police corruption abounded in the years that followed, the case remained unsolved and the girls were never found. In 2015, crime writer Jax Miller, who had been haunted by the case, decided to travel to Oklahoma to find out what really happened on that winter night in 1999 and why the story was still simmering more than 15 years later. What she found was more than she could have ever bargained for, evidence of jaw-dropping levels of police negligence, entire communities ravaged by methamphetamine addiction, and a series of interconnected murders with an ominously familiar pattern. These forgotten towns were wild, lawless, and home to some very dark secrets. The book that we're featuring this evening is Hell in the Heartland: Murder, Meth, and the Case of Two Missing Girls, with my special guest, journalist, author, TV producer, filmmaker, Jax Miller. Thank you so much for joining us on the program today to discuss your remarkable new book. Welcome to the program, Jax Miller.
Hi, thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate this.
Thank you so much for joining us. Right away, let's talk about what brought you to the case of Ashley Freeman and Loria Bible. How did you come to be involved?
I never have a good answer for that. I can't remember where I first heard the story, but in 2015, I made the choice to move from fiction to nonfiction, and I remember this case. I did a Google search, something like, you know, best friends, trailer, fire, prairie, and, you know, I wanted to see if anything had happened with this story. And lo and behold, you know, at that time, they were actually looking for the remains of the girls in the well of a convicted murderer. And I says, wow, this is still so active 15 years later. You know, this is what I want to do. So I called Loria Bible's mother, Loreen Bible, and I says, hey, I'm thinking about writing a book. And here we are, you know, all this time later, and the book's coming out tomorrow. It's kind of surreal.
Absolutely. And there's so much going on as well, because there's a Kansas man pleads guilty just July 15th. This was in the newspapers, 2020, in Vinita, Oklahoma, and we'll get to that. We'll get to that incredible development in this story and incredibly in this case. Let's talk about the particulars. Let's talk about all of the incredible and horrible particulars of these heinous murders and their discovery. So take us back to December 28th.
So it was actually the morning of December 30th, and there was a trailer, and this is real tucked in. This is real rural. and there's a trailer home they found on fire. Inside, they found the body of 38-year-old Kathy Freeman, her burnt body. She was shot to death prior to the fire being started. So it was first assumed that her husband, Danny Freeman, had killed her and then had taken their 16-year-old daughter, Ashley Freeman, and Ashley's best friend, Laura Bible, who was sleeping over the night before. It was assumed that he had killed his wife, taken the girls, and left. Soon after, a tip came in to police saying, you know, Danny has the girls. He's not going to give them back until cops hand over the officer who shot his son less than 1 year prior. So that was the prominent theory of those first 24 hours. The next day, at daybreak, the family of the friend, Laura Bible, who was sleeping over, they go to look for clues. They go back to the crime scene. There's no one there. The cops are gone. The scene was released the evening before. And within moments of arriving, they find a second body that police failed to find, and that was their prime suspect, Danny Freeman. So now you have these two dead parents and these girls are missing ever since. They've never been found. And that's the basis of this, of Hell in the Heartland, for the most part.
Now, when you arrive from Ireland and you come to this little place in Oklahoma and you meet Lorene Bible, what is the first thing that you deduce from this and her spirit and her character? What are the first things that you recognize upon arrival?
Well, yeah, I think coming into it, I was kind of expecting that grieving mother who, you know, wails and, you know, clenches her fists at the heavens type of woman. And she's anything but. She's a very reserved woman. Something that took a lot of getting used to coming from Ireland to Oklahoma was that Midwestern stoicism that you see so often around here, just very still, very reserved and composed. So that took a lot in getting used to, but there's a power in that. There really is, because she's very forward thinking. She doesn't get caught up in the emotion. She doesn't get caught up in the theories and the hypotheses. Her immediate response is always, what do I have to do next? What do I have to do next? And she's just always moving forward. And I was very impressed by that. I think she's a fascinating woman. I think she's a powerful woman. I think she's the strongest woman I've ever met. And, you know, I think we could all learn something from people like Lorene. I think she's just amazing.
Now, you talked about the tip that police got that they immediately assumed that Danny Freeman was the culprit in this murder and arson. But you say that Lorene immediately and her husband were the people that took upon themselves to make the search for their daughter and inextricably became involved in this case to the point where they discover that Danny Freeman's in the fire as well. Now, tell us about, because this book is obviously, and Lorene is highly critical of the police reaction initially and beyond initially. So tell us how this could have possibly happened, this oversight, and some of the things that you describe in the book about this investigation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the big question. How does two parents, you know, and these are nice people, wholesome people, how do they find this body? And it's not a pretty scene. He's burnt to death. His head's been shot off. If you ask Lorene Bible, she'll tell you it looked like hamburger meat. This was a gory, horrible thing to stumble upon. And your daughter is missing. I mean, under these circumstances, how can you even fathom that? People like you and I, we're not meant to fathom stuff like this. No one is. And the big question is, how the hell did police miss this? And that was the question that kept ringing. So from then on, Lorene and Jay, as soon as they found Danny Freeman, they says, no, we're not giving the scene back to them. They released it to the family. It's ours now. And it was Lorene and Jay and Danny Freeman's stepbrother, Dwayne Vansell, also, who they'd released the scene to. They were the ones who really led this. And they had volunteers, you know, and that's a great thing about living in a small community. You know, they had like In the first few days, they had up to 500 volunteers, people looking on horseback, and the Bibles were conducting the grid searches. You know, there's even a lot of people don't know this, but they were putting down their own evidence markers while agents from the state sat on the sides, and then they would put the evidence markers down, and then they would call back to the agents to come collect it. And it was just one mishap after another, after another, after another. And it's like, at what point, you know, does somebody do something? And Loreen and Jay just did everything themselves. God bless them. And Dwayne Bansal, too, with that investigation those first few days, they did everything they could. And they had a lot working against them. Like, the agent did not enter the girls into the NCIC like he should have. There was no arson investigation. And it's one of them stories over the years. Reports go missing. This never happened. This person's dead. You know, it's a very frustrating case in that sense.
We talked about the tip to police. Police must have investigated that because it was a dangerous bit of misinformation. So what about that tip to police? What did they find about that tip?
Well, I'll just preface by saying that the sheriff's office did not investigate. As soon as they got there, they put their hands up and said, "We have too much bad blood with this family. We need to surrender this to the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation." So for the first few hours, as this house is burning and they're putting out the fire, the sheriff's office is sitting there. Even after the fire's out, they don't go inside. They don't investigate. They don't search for the girls. They just wait. And even Loreen Bible and Dwayne and everyone else is like, what are you doing? Do something. And they didn't. Now, this all said, the reason that they put their hands up and surrendered this over was because less than a year prior, in early 1999, January 8th, 1999, Kathy and Danny Freeman's 17-year-old son, Shane Freeman, was killed by a local sheriff's deputy. The family thought that they might have a case of a wrongful death suit. They were going to file a wrongful death suit against the county. They had 1 year to do so, what they believed that they had 1 year to do so, and 1 week shy of that one-year window closing, they were murdered. So a lot of this, you know, Shane Freeman has brought in a lot. I talk a lot about Shane Freeman in the book. And, so that was the tip, was that Danny was going to kidnap the girls and he wasn't giving them back until police handed over Deputy David Hayes, who's the cop who shot his son. And he, I think he was expecting a shootout. I think that's how the tip said it, was that there was going to be a shootout, like, come and get me, come and get the girls and give me him. And, of course, we now know, upon the Bibles finding Danny Freeman, that tip was false.
You also have, not to backtrack so much, but this is just so dramatic and disturbing, is that when the initial Troy Resick comes to see
Messick,
finds out about the fire and wants to notify Loreen. How does he go about that? Just to start off this whole nightmare for her.
So that morning, she was working at McDonald's, Loreen was. And at first she had a call from her son, Brad, that older brother. And he said something like, "Mom, you know, there's a fire out in Welch," because his girlfriend lived in Welch at the time, you know. And at first, nobody really thought that much of it. I think everyone kind of imagined a small kitchen fire. Nobody knew it was as severe as it was. So she hung up the phone with Brad, and moments later, you know, Deputy Messick comes in, and he says, "Loreen, we got to talk." And she'll tell you, like, I knew from his face that it was serious, you know, that the place had burnt down. From there, she actually relayed information to Messick, who then related it to the authorities back on the scene, where what the layout of the trailer was. So it's like, according to Loreen, Danny's room is here, Ashley's room is here, Shane's room was here, you know, and she's actually from McDonald's, giving them the layout of the land, the layout of land out there. So. And then she and then she called Jay. She called her husband Jay, and then Jay picked her up, and then together they went to the crime scene.
Now, when we talk about the search, this extensive search with the 500 volunteers, how did they endeavor to conduct this search? What did they have any start for that search? Did they have any leads to direct them in this search?
So, The 500 people wasn't until about day three, I believe. At first, you know, it's a very small town. Word travels very quickly. So people came, you know, wanting to know what's up. And a lot of them came, like, just like with that nosy sense, like, you know, hey, what's going on? people listen to their police scanners out there. That's a very common thing you'll see. Even the funeral parlor set up a tent and started handing out drinks and sandwiches to people. And people were letting their kids run around the crime scene, like babies, you know, in diapers. Mm-hmm. It was a circus. And all the while on that second day, you have 25 agents just standing on the sidelines. And Marines like, don't you come near this. You stay put. and they did. And I understand where Lorene came from. I totally feel for her why she would do that, because they failed to find Danny the day before. But I also don't understand why agents let her, why they didn't, you know, try and investigate this properly. And it wasn't just finding Danny's body. There was, you know, the elite agent, he hadn't, you know, entered the girls into the NCIC. Lorene did that herself. They weren't planning searches. That second or third day, Jay Bible, the father of Laura Bible, he called the radio station and appealed for volunteers, and that's how most of them came the next day. And what they did was they formed an assembly line down the driveway, and they all came with these handmade sifters, and they went through one clump of ash at a time looking for bones. That's pretty much what they did, like, the whole time until every inch was covered. And there was no sign of the girls. Nobody believes the girls were in that fire.
Wow. Now, you talked about this bad blood, and that's because over this shooting and the sheriff's department being involved. But is there more to them not investigating? Like you described them sitting around, Lorene comes to the scene. They have to have the medical examiner come, so they're sitting down. So is there a sense of callousness or indifference because of that bad blood and because of the character behind some of these people in the police mind? Is there that kind of feel to this thing?
I mean, I think this whole story begs the question: was this incompetence or was this corruption? You know, I do talk about it because there was a history with the sheriff's office of corruption. It wasn't new, unfortunately. And I'm not saying that they were all bad by any means. Personally, I think there was one bad one. I have his colleagues on record saying he sold meth out of the trunk of his car, and he was the one who was primarily doing the harassment against Danny Freeman. And we have this documented where the police went back and forth, and it was like shining spotlights in the Freeman home in the middle of the night, following Ashley off the school bus. Like, they were very, you know, just harassing. And it was mostly this one character. He's dead now. And Danny was the same way. I mean, he was stalking the cop who shot his son. Whether or not that was a justifiable shooting, that's still another question, another story,
right,
if you will. But, I mean, it was a tit for tat for that whole year. You know, and you have to remember, small towns, you know, most of these people know one another anyway outside the badge. They've known each other for years. And whether or not it was a callousness, whether or not they knew Danny was there and just decided to ignore him and hope nobody else noticed, you know, all these things, if it was a callousness or not, I don't know. I think it's up for readers to decide, you know, what you think. Because even in talking to the families, you know, the Bibles don't dwell so much on the corruption side of law enforcement because they believe that will take the focus away from the girls, whereas the
right.
Freemans are very vocal that they're going to go to their graves believing that the cops did this and that the cops, you know, had the men we now know are the suspects, that they had them do it. So there is that great divide.
Let's get back to this partnership, this friendship, this relationship that you develop with Lorene. You're incredibly candid about how obsessed you were with this case. And your first book that was a major success was Freedom's Child. And the issues explored in there, your relationship with Lorene, they have something to do with each other. At least your book and your experiences, your personal experiences, informed you and were present in this relationship, I believe, from my reading. Tell us a little bit about the relationship and what major things you learned in this relationship.
You know, Lorene just threatened to throw a peach at my forehead yesterday. Like, we have... we have this loving relationship, I think. You know, it's not all serious. We don't sit there and dwell over the case. It's really not like that. It's and there are times for that. But, you know, it's grown, you know, separate from her case and her story and me going through this book. There was a lot that I went through emotionally. There were things, you know, outside this case, like my mother's passing and, you know, moving, stuff like this. I had my own, you know, trials, and she was there for them. You know, there's something very motherly and very nurturing underneath that cold, hard exterior. And she is, I really think the world of her. I don't know if she feels the same way for me, but I do think the world of her. I look up to her because I never met anyone like her. And checking myself and checking my own heart and seeing the woman that I want to be, it's a lot more like Laureen. I was struck by her. I was very struck by her. I don't know if you've ever seen interviews with her. She's a different breed, if you will.
Yes. Now, this is you undertake this, and you had no idea, as you write, that this would be a 4-year investigation. You did not have these kinds of plans for this kind of extensive stay. What did you find in this investigation? And you write about your own experiences, serious experiences with drugs, but this community plagued by methamphetamine, were you surprised? And how important was the methamphetamine to this story and this investigation?
So meth was a huge aspect to this story because it has such a huge impact on this community. There are parts of this area that have been devastated by poverty. If you look at Pitcher, Oklahoma, which is where the girls were thought to have been murdered, it's where the suspects lived at the time. And that's,
right.
You know, it's not far from Welch, Oklahoma. But Pitcher, Oklahoma was a huge lead mining town that's collapsed. It's full of sinkholes and empty homes. And it, you know, there's no one there now. But back then it was making, you know, it really lended towards the meth problem that you see in the area today. And for me, I'm a big believer that nothing bad should ever be gone in vain. I believe that the bad parts, the bad things that have happened, the bad choices we make, we can use them later on, you know, with that silver lining. And I'm very open about my past as a drug addict. I never did meth, but, you know, I'm very open about my own struggles with addiction. And I think that was a huge asset for me in this case, actually, because I think a lot of people in the genre, whether or not they're a writer or a journalist or even law enforcement, you know, just anyone who has to deal with victims and suspects, I think a lot of times they can be a little pretentious. They come in there with you know, their stiff suit and a notebook, and they're asking questions like they're a little bit better than them, a little bit pretentious. And I'm not saying everyone. I've just seen this before. And
right.
I really did not want to be that person. I really wanted to meet them wherever they were. And I remember in my own struggles with addiction, the person who really helped me was someone who met me where I was. You know what I'm saying? So that was important
right.
to me. So when I'm dealing with meth addicts, and I don't like the labels, first of all. I don't like the labels because I don't think that defines who you are as a person. It doesn't define me. It doesn't define them. I mean, these people, you know, are someone's parent and child and sibling, and people forget that. You know, I think it's easy for people to say, oh, they're just junkies, you know, let them be. So I would meet them where they're at, and sometimes I'd sit with them while they got high. Sometimes I sat with them while they cried. Sometimes I sat with them, you know, and lit their cigarette, and other times we would just joke around and have a great meal. I mean, you meet them wherever they're at because I think this business – should require a foundation of trust. For me, that was 90% of the job, was building that foundation of trust. And even now, like, I send them Christmas cards. We talk. I mean, I'm just very friendly with them. I just play it cool, I guess. And I don't know if that's dumb or not, but, you know, it's how I roll, I suppose.
Right. Now, is it, in this investigation, we have alluded to that this case has changed and there's this trial that's going to go on, and that needs to be explained as well, because it's a trial, it's a plea agreement. So it's a fascinating development that has happened, but it didn't happen overnight. So tell us about the investigation, your investigation as well in Lorene's, and how you came to the discovery of potential suspects in the first place and the eventual suspect that is now charged. But tell us about this investigation and the hunt for suspects in the first place.
So when I first came to this story, their prime suspect was someone who had confessed maybe 10 years prior. It was a man who's now on death row, an alleged serial killer named Jeremy Jones. And he was a suspect for a long time, and there was no one else. There was no other big lead. So the three men now that we now believe, you know, had killed the girls.
Right.
We would hear their names once in a while, but they were, you know, they didn't raise huge red flags. And a lot of these red flags came after the arrest. Then it was a lot of aha moments. But so I'd heard these names. The family had heard these names, but they've also heard hundreds of other names. So, you know, it's like, what do you do with it? You know, this is why you need investigators. So it was kind of like the perfect storm. At around the same time that I came to the story, there was the family created the Find Laura Bible page on Facebook. And that really opened the door for families to get a lot of new tips. Also around the same time, there was a new team of investigators. And this was like the first time on an official level that this case was really being looked at, like really
right.
being investigated. And that's with the OSBI agent, Tammy Ferrari, and the DA's investigator, Gary Stansel. So you kind of have this perfect storm. And then it's like the floodgates opened really wide. And, you know, people started talking about Ronnie Busick. They started talking about David Pennington, and they started talking about Phil Welch. Welch and Pennington have died. It's believed that Phil Welch was kind of the ringleader in this. Talking to his family, talking to people who knew him, he was quite a terrifying man, to say the least. And it sounds like he had the other two kind of under his spell. So we knew that the arrest was going to happen for some time. But then the affidavits released that same day, the 2018 affidavit, and everyone learns for the first time about these pictures that were produced that had showed the girls being held against their will. I don't know the full details of what's in the pictures. I don't know if
right.
they've kept that from the families for their own sake or if they just don't know. I'm not sure. But the girls were held captive, and then all these witnesses came forward, and here we are today. So, I mean, going into this story, none of this was anticipated. And being a part of it, watching this happen, and, you know, it's been so surreal. And in a way, I feel
yeah.
so honored that they have let me in so greatly. Now, of course, you know, there is an arm's length. I don't know everything. And I know for the sake of the
right.
case, there are things that they don't tell me. And I don't budge. I totally respect that.
Right.
So it's just been really surreal, but I am so thankful. I am so thankful that this case is progressing the way it has. And I really hope it progresses, especially in the next few weeks. You know, Ronnie Busick has only a few weeks to produce the bodies of Ashley and Laura in return for a lighter sentence. He pled guilty last week. And it's just been a wild, crazy roller coaster.
Well, tell us more about this incredible deal, because he gets a certain sentence if he doesn't cooperate and lead authorities to these bodies. So, but what is the, okay, so tell us the entire deal, what he doesn't get and what he does get out of this agreement. What does he have to do to fulfill it?
So Ronnie Busick has pled guilty to accessory to murder. He is beginning to talk. I know last week before a judge, he says, I haven't been completely honest. You know, this is one of them things where they kind of keep me at arm's length. And I think
mm-hmm.
that, you know, they of course hold back details, because if there are more people, they want to come forward. And families and law enforcement do believe there are more people out there with information, then there's that holdback
mm-hmm.
information. So they don't share everything
right.
with me.
No.
But he apparently is beginning to talk, and the details of the agreement are, if he does produce the bodies, he will serve 5 years plus probation. If he does not, then he will serve 15 years. And if you've ever seen Ronnie Busick, you know, he's not in the best health. You know, 15 years is probably a life sentence for him.
Right.
I know a lot of people are angry about this. A lot of people are very, only 5 years, only 15 years, What's wrong with you? But you
That's
have
right.
to kind of imagine what the families are going through when their number one priority is to find the girls, and this might be their only hope. So it's kind of, you know, it wasn't an easy thing. And like you said, it wasn't something that happened overnight. You know, I think they prayed real hard. I think they thought real hard, and they discussed it for a long time. And this was what they believed was best for them.
You talk about people being outraged, and I understand that, but then I understand, you know, the legal procedures that that he had some leverage over these investigators, and that's why they couldn't, they had to drop certain charges, and that's why it's a plea agreement. They have to offer something. So they didn't have sufficient evidence, obviously, to prosecute him, charge him for murder. So this is the best compromise that these people can exert on this Busick. So it's the best that they can possibly do. But tell our audience what the investigators believe that Busick, along with Philip Welsh II and David Pennington, did to these young girls.
So from
and why?
So from what I understand, and I kind of learn as I go, I learned a detail, and I'm only saying this because Lorene and Dwayne mentioned it on an interview yesterday, and this was new to me, that they went there, they killed the family. The girls had escaped. And the girls ran out the back door. And this was new to me. And when I heard it on the interview, I started crying just hearing it. I was like, I had to hide from Lorene and just get misty-eyed. That they went in the back. They were in the pasture. They poked their heads up, and one of them saw them. And had they not tried escaping, you know, I don't know. Or had they not poked up their head, they might have made it. But that was a new detail. From there, it's believed that they took the girls back to Phil Welch's trailer in Pitcher, which was then still deteriorating. Now it's a ghost town, but I don't think it was quite a ghost town yet.
Right.
We know from witnesses and what was said in the affidavit was that, you know, everyone, they drugged the girls, they raped the girls, they sodomized the girls, they, you know, tortured them for 1 to 2 weeks. There have been ample rumors about a party. There was a revolving door. And you have to understand, in this meth world, it wasn't – I don't believe it was just those three men. I do not believe that. That's why I believe, you know, that there's more people out there, and I hope that that book reaches those people. But as far as the deaths, it's alleged, based on what witnesses have said in the affidavit, that Phil Welch strangled the girls and then proceeded to – dispose of their bodies in one of the many mines in Pitcher. I know for a long time everyone's focuses have been on Pitcher, you know, which is a ghost town. It was once a thriving lead mining town, but now it's full of sinkholes and mines. And there is the horrifying, you know, possibility that you might never find these girls because these mines have long collapsed or they flush.
Right.
I mean, when I say mines, I mean underground cities. They used to have 18-wheeler, you know, highways for 18-wheelers, interstate highways underground. These are not little mine shafts you see in, it was its own underground city. And if you look at pictures of Pitcher underground, it's like cathedrals underground. Like it's thousands of square miles of this. It's, I never knew such a place even existed in America, but I assure you it's there. But that's where it's largely believed that Phil Welch and possibly others dispose of the girls. I know the most recent searches have focused on that area. Now, of course, there's the possibility they're not there, but that is where they focus. It also bears mentioning that they believe Phil Welch was kind of the ringleader in all this, and I think Pennington and Busick were kind of the tag-alongs, if you will, and who possibly set the fire.
And you talk about Ronnie Busick, too. He's 68 years old out of this, so that's the reality of this too, that if he were to get the 15 years, he might not outlive that. So that's very interesting.
And he's a very old 68. He's a very old 68. He's been shot in the head, so he's not all there, and he's spent a lifetime addicted to meth. So he's a very old 68.
And he was arrested while he was in prison. So he's spent considerable time in prison already and was arrested for these crimes while he was in prison too.
Right. They had arrested him on drug charges up in Kansas. But he has spent most of his life in and out of jail. He knows the system. And I think that's why everybody fears he might be, you know, just kind of jerking the authorities around because he does know the system. He's a little bit clever in that sense.
this very interesting, important date is August 31st. So he has a deadline. It isn't that you're going to assist us in trying to find these bodies. He has a deadline to find these bodies, or they have a deadline, which is August 31st. Very interesting.
Right. Right.
Now,
sorry.
What's Lorene and Jay's thoughts about this development? And you mentioned about the 5 years and the 15 years. What are her thoughts about this entire development and this August 31st event?
You know, this wasn't something that was taken lightly. I know that the family is alongside, like with the DA, you know, Ballard, with the attorney for the with the ADA. I know everyone sat down and discussed this for a long time, for weeks, maybe even months. So this wasn't anything new. And when I've asked Lorene in the past, like, how do you feel about this? Does this give you some semblance of closure? When I ask her things like this, her answer is always the same. Nothing is solved. Nothing is finished until I find Laura, you know, until I find my daughter. So despite the arrest, I think she's happy to see him do some jail time, but it's very pale compared to her wishes to find Laura. That's her only prerogative in this life.
What was it like for her to finally get a contact from police and have this arrest of this suspect? And what was it like for her, if she shared it with you, just her reaction to finding out the reality of what happened to her daughter, the horrible reality of what happened to her daughter and her friend?
I don't think she's any stranger to this, you know. And I remember when I first met her tiptoeing around these details, but she's very forward. She's very forthcoming, and she's no stranger to the horrors. I mean, absolute horrors of this case. She really wears the pants in this investigation, in a sense, because she, you know, nothing. I mean, she knows everything. She really does. And she's been hearing rumors about this party since the first week. Since the very early days. Yeah. And, you know, she's heard about this party, or she's heard this name, or she's heard that name. I mean, she's heard horror stories that you know, you wouldn't be able to sleep. So I don't think any of them are shocking to her. And if they are, she won't show me. She won't show anyone. You know, I think for her, in her mind and her way of thinking, which is quite unique, she's like, okay, great. What's next? What's next? What's next? We got Ronnie. What's next? He's got a plea deal. What's next? And that's how her mind works.
Right.
It is not how my mind works. My mind works. Of course, I'm a storyteller, so I'm thinking of theories and hypotheses, and my imagination would run away with me. Not her. What next? What next? What next? And that's how. You know, I've asked her, I've asked her family members, I'm like, has she always been like this, or is this just because of this case? And she's like, no, she's always been like that. That's who, she was born this way, you know.
You talk about Lorene not really the police cooperating with her, or, you know, she wasn't, I guess, satisfied with the response of the police and their investigation. What about this new team of investigators? Was there a difference, and that did that make her have more confidence that something would happen in this case?
I think right off the bat there is the skepticism, and I think that would be anyone. I think when you've dealt with law enforcement or haven't dealt with law enforcement as much as Lorene has, of course you're skeptical. Like, okay, well, we'll see. And I think it was very clear, again, Lorene kind of wears the pants here. So when this new team came forward, and it's headed by DA investigator Gary Stansel. Now, Stansel had retired from Tulsa. He was a sex crimes, I don't know what his actual title was, but he worked in sex crime, and he retired from there. And he took on this case almost as his own personal project. This isn't like some assignment he has. He's retired. So, you know, this is like a personal thing for him. And I think he really took on the lead with this story. And even though there is that natural skepticism, you know, kind of like, well, we'll see. And a lot of it's like Lorene is like, here's the information I have. What are you going to do with it? And a lot of it's also Lorene saying, I'm going here. And that's what happened with Ronnie Busick. You know, she's like, I got a tip or a few tips. you know, I'm going here, you're coming with me or you're not. And they went with her. You know, that's how it went. But this all said, they are very good. They, I know the Bibles and Freemans on both sides are very happy with the direction Stancil and Ferrari have taken this investigation. They're making so much progress. And, you know, if I've said it once, I've said it a million times, there's been more progress just in the past 4 years or even 2 years, I think, you know, than there has been in all those 20 years. And I know those investigators are doing a very good job.
What about this book due out tomorrow? How satisfied or do you think Lorene is about this book?
She has a very unique approach. She sees this as another avenue to get the story out there. You know, this story hasn't been very national. It's been largely regional and local. And her sentiment is, okay, you know, here's just another avenue. Here's just another avenue. Here's just another avenue. So that's what I hope it does. I really hope that this is a productive avenue for her. I hope it does reach that right person. You know, I gave her a copy of the book the other day. I says, here, you can use it as a doorstop. I was joking. I really do hope that this does help bring the publicity, because I think the publicity helps. I know with, you know, press stuff in the past, every time there's a boost in the publicity, the tips do come forward and people do pay attention. So I really do hope this book helps her and her, you know, crusade. And again, I think there are people who are still out there who know something. I think people are afraid. I know a lot of people say they're afraid. Some will say they're afraid of cops. I've heard people say they're afraid of Phil Welch, who's been dead for years now. Right. And then there are people who are just very wrapped up in that lifestyle and they're afraid of getting in trouble. You know, you're dealing with a lot of people addicted to methamphetamine and they're scared of getting in trouble or I've waited this long. It'll look bad if I say something now because I didn't say it 20 years ago, you know. So I really hope this book reaches that right person. I hope it reaches them on a day where it'll strike a chord and make them come forward and help.
Yes. You say, too, meeting Lorene, going through this as well, you talk about the Oklahoma way in terms of no crying and just this steely resolve. How did it help you? How did this whole thing help you?
This was a very transformative thing to happen to me in many ways, and that was not something I was anticipating. I'm a New Yorker. I'm very expressive. I yell. I use my hands when I talk. I let you know how I feel. I wear my heart on my sleeve. And going to Oklahoma, they are not that. And that's not all of Oklahoma. That's just largely in this region, maybe. And, you know, they're just very reserved. They're very still and composed. And I was so struck by that. I was so impressed by that. And I said, that's what I want to be more like. Now, I talk about the book about my mental health. I talk about my anxiety and my panic attacks and stuff like this. And going through that, you know, I mean, I remember one time I was panicking. I had a threat. And I called Lorene just panicking. I'm like, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. And she talked me down. She's like, take a deep breath. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to put yourself in a bedroom. You're going to stay away from the windows. You're going to call the sheriff. You know, and she talked me down. And I'm like, this is what I want to be. This is who I want to be, you know, instead of that reactive, you know, loud.
Yeah.
And as I'm sure you can tell, I do talk a lot. I go, yepity, yepity, yepity. Yep. But, you know, I really did want to be more like that. And she taught me so much. And not just her, but everyone, you know, here in Oklahoma has taught me so much about who I want to be as a woman and who I want to be on an emotional level. And I'm so grateful for that, you know. Here I was thinking I'd go into their lives, but they came into mine as much, and it's been a real, very fortunate thing.
You take the reader into this investigation as well with you and Lorene, and it was not without dangers as well. You describe some of the conditions that you had to do for these interviews and some of the people you met and some of the, I guess, the fear that you felt.
I think, you know, it's important to preface by saying that this case was through a lens of crippling anxiety and panic. not so much because of this case. I think kind of just reared its head during this, you know, during this case.
Okay.
My mother, her mother, my great grandma, they all had it. So I think there was already a bit of fear that may not have been 100%. I'm trying to think of a word. What's the word? Not appropriate, but it may not have been. Sorry, I'm having a brain fart right now. Can I start that question all over, or are we live?
I see what you mean. I do see what you mean, though.
Yeah. So, and you know, and of course there were threats, and you know, and there was a lot of, you know, feeling in danger. A few times I faced a loaded gun, and there were people like, you know, get out of here. You know, you're messing with some dangerous stuff. I mean, even cops. You know, they're like, I would talk to you, but people will kill me. There is a lot of that. And I think a lot of the danger comes not necessarily from this case directly, but from people in the methamphetamines world. I mean, people on meth can be very unpredictable. They can be dangerous. There were times when I would have them stalk me. There was one in particular who stalked me. He continues to stalk me. I had to go to the sheriff with that information. So it is scary. But it wasn't directly the case. It was just, you know, this lifestyle that you see a lot in the area. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't directly related to Lauren Ashley.
Right.
But it was scary. And, you know, I'd be lying if I said I'm not scared anymore. You know, I still have times where I'm like, I'm nervous. I'm pretty nervous.
Yeah, understandable. Before I let you go, tell us about the anticipation of August 31st, and also, is there other information, obviously, that will be gained after that date or as a result of that court date? Will there be more answers and more information, like the incredible graphic and horrible details of the murder and the rape and the being held captive? Is there more information to come? And will it come from this plea agreement or this court date on August 31st?
You know, so something I've also learned from families is don't get your hopes up, you know. And I've asked Lorraine, like, are you excited about this? And, you know, she's like, she doesn't get on those emotional roller coasters. And that's something I learned, because early on, like, when they would do search, I'm like, this is it, let's do it, let's go. And, like, you get your hopes up, and then you're devastated when things don't work out the way you want them to. So I've learned, especially because of this case, not to get my hopes up and just be still and, you know, just wait. And that's what we're doing. So yes, I'm excited. It would be very easy for me to be like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. But I'm trying to keep still, and, you know, I'm taking a page out of the Bible book, you know.
And
we'll see where it goes. Will it produce information? I think if they do find the girls, hopefully, I don't know in what condition, you know, in what context that they would be found, if medical examiners could figure out something. I really don't know. But I do know Lorreen has largely avoided pointing to police corruption, police negligence, and all the things that the Freemans are very vocal about, because she wants the focus to remain on finding the girls. And I think when the girls are found, I think she's going to have another fight before her.
Wow. Yeah. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about Hell in the Heartland, Murder, Meth, and the Case of Two Missing Girls. It is a fascinating book, and it's been a pleasure to speak to you about it today. For people that might want to find out a little bit more information, is there a website, a Facebook page? Tell us a little bit more how they might find out about more information or contact you.
So if they want to reach out to me, I'm all over social media, Instagram, Twitter, but mostly I'm on Facebook at Real Jax Miller. Also, the Bible Family has a page which they keep up to date very regularly, especially in light of this stuff with Ronnie Busick in jail, and that's Find Laura Bible. Laura is spelled L-A-U-R-I-A, and that's a great page to follow.
Yes. Thank you so much. It's been fascinating.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jax Miller.
I appreciate it. Take care.
Good night.